tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. What is inflation? What causes it? Why are we in the midst of an inflationary cold war, as it were? Well, in common sense, it's entirely too much money chasing too few goods. And where does all that money come from? You know, very few American people would think to trace inflation of today right back to Vietnam. The single major reason for inflation today was, believe it or not, the doubling of money supply in the United States from 1964 on. Massive government spending, together with not any really significant rise in taxes, dumped so much money into circulation, and so many people were so eagerly desiring to get theirs while the getting was good, that we simply had entirely too much money chasing too few goods. Now, where does that great money supply come from? Well, the government printing offices produce it. Money is merely paper. Money is nothing of itself. The entire thing is a confidence game. And we in the United States are now suffering from the combined evils of runaway inflation on the one hand, and a deepening recession headed toward depression if something doesn't avert it, on the other hand. And the two, in one sense of the word, have nothing totally in common. They're a terrible thing to have together, because that makes it all the worse. If you fuel the one, that is business and industry, by trying to put more money in circulation and more government spending to increase borrowings and therefore to fuel such industries as home building and automobile manufacturing and the like, then you increasingly cause inflation to rise. If you slow down inflation, trying to clamp down on the money in circulation, you deepen the recession and head toward a depression. And so no wonder it's a terrible headache today with recession and inflation at the same time. Well, let's see if we can understand exactly what inflation is and take a look at inflation around the world as history would view it, because history tells us that no democracy has ever survived for very long with an inflation rate of more than 20%. Yet some of the world's great industrial nations have already passed the 20% mark. And Japan is one very notable example of that. Other countries are approaching it very closely, because some countries have a rate of 16 to 17%, like Britain and Denmark. West Germany, the Netherlands, may escape with about a 10% or less. West Germany, 7 or 8%, the last time I heard, which was only days ago. And the real major reason for this is the fourfold rise in oil prices that I've talked about ever since the Yom Kippur War, and even before, so far as knowing that the Arabs would someday, with concerted action, use oil as a virtual political blackmail, a weapon to throw the entirety of the Western developed world into economic chaos. And suddenly, little countries you scarcely knew where they were, you could scarcely pronounce their names, and many people still don't know where they are, and still can't pronounce their names. Places like Dubai and Qatar, Kuwait, most people over there call it Kuwait instead of Kuwait, and of course Abu Dhabi. Whoever heard of Abu Dhabi? I remember hearing the Sheikh of Abu Dhabi speak at the airport in Amman many years ago in 1966, before the Jew-Arab War of 67. I had to, I confess, go find myself a map and look it up and find out where in the world that little Arab sheikdom was. And yet today, some of those countries are some of the richest on the face of the earth, and some of the former great powerful countries are becoming impoverished. Australia has an inflation rate of about 16%, Brazil 14%, but really bankers and economists there claim that that's just a government figure, and that the reality that people are living with down there is closer to about 25-24%. Canada has an inflation rate of about 10%, India 15%, Sweden is about 8%, about the same as West Germany. West Germany is slightly lower than that, perhaps, and really the lowest in the industrialized world. But as I was saying recently, that is so high that when Helmut Schmidt came to Washington, the West German chancellor was asking the American president to try to fuel the American business and to combat recession, forgetting inflation for the time being, because recession in the United States is also helping to cause the deep problem inside West Germany. And so it goes around the world. France has about a 16% rate, Greece over 33%. If you want an example of what inflation can do to a country that thinks it is sailing along in pretty good economic shape, you can take a look at what happened in Uruguay recently. Because that government had to announce that Uruguay had never experienced any kind of an inflation on the order of what happened in Germany after the First World War, or what happened in China. after the Second World War. And they were complaining there that they had never before seen everything just virtually demolished so far as the social structure was concerned and various state-old institutions. And there's a writer and a novelist who now lives in England and gives his account of conditions in Uruguay. His name is Naipaul, and he has been there for a long time. But he talks about terminal inflation there, just one case in point of what this kind of inflation can do to a country. He says 20 years ago, Uruguay was called the Switzerland of South America. It was rich. Its peso was among some of the strongest currencies in the world. It was gold, too, and its people were the best educated, supposedly, in South America. Now, the country, he says, is demoralized, is impoverished, and now the peso, which was worth 33 cents back in 1953, is worth slightly over a tenth of a cent today. In 1953, you could go to Uruguay, and there were 3 pesos to the dollar. You could buy 3 pesos. Today, you get down there, you can buy 975 of them for a dollar. And the money has run out. And hardly anybody can drive a car. The country's ruled by a dictator. There's a kind of a calamity because they finally reached rock bottom. Now, where they were rich, it seems now that everybody is impoverished. It all seemed to start with a kind of a welfare battle, a welfare state. And what began to happen was giving all kinds of rights and benefits and pensions, and there were everything from women's rights and workers' benefits handed down month after month, and liberalizing of laws to an astonished people that were basically agrarian and pastoral in nature. And then suddenly, it seemed like Uruguay joined the modern thinking countries, best educated countries, and they had football, and it became an obsession. But you know, even football has decayed with the rest of the economy. And even some of the better footballers have had to be sold off and traded to other countries because Uruguay can't afford to pay them anything to entertain the people anymore. One of the jokes about Uruguay, of which there are many, is that out of a workforce of just over 1,250,000 are employed by the state. The airline down there used to have about 1,000 employees and one functioning airplane. How about that? And in one state oil company, they had an office building, and there were too many employees to go around for the chairs and the desks they were able to afford. They didn't all have a place to sit down. And so the civil service was padded, and the whole state had been led into a kind of a conspiracy against itself. And one businessman said that everybody seems to be pension-minded, and the simplest things have to be smuggled in anymore. Those who can are trying to get out. They're lining up for passports and the like. So from a nation that seemed to be on the way up, the Switzerland of South America, a nation that was comfortable, a nation with a strong currency, we now see a country that is toppling, fraying, coming apart at the seams. The difference between 33 cents to the peso, slightly over, you know, right at three, really, to a dollar, to 975, to a dollar today. Well, that's what can happen in a modern nation. Now, going back in history, I said that history tells us no democracy has survived for long with an inflation rate at more than about 20%. Well, look what happened in Germany way back prior to World War II, in the post-World War I deep depression that struck there. And this was even before the great crash in 1929 in the United States, but they were so impoverished it was unbelievable. Money wasn't even counted in the banks in Germany. It was weighed, you imagine that, by the pounds or whatever they used. Imagine having a ton of money, literally. I guess some people did, but it wasn't worth much. People had to carry knapsacks, you know, big like bags around their necks and over their shoulders instead of wallets. They replaced their wallets with knapsacks because you couldn't get enough money in a wallet to even buy a stamp, and that's a fact. As I said on a TV program we did on the subject, and we showed what happened in that deep recession, the incredible impoverishment of the German people, which led directly toward an extremist government and the rise of Hitler. Factory workers had to be paid 2 and 3 times a day. And then the wives would get the money out of the gates and rush down to the stores to try to buy something before it was all sold out. There wasn't much to buy. Actually, the entire economy went down to a simple barter economy where farmers simply didn't bother taking goods to market but would trade back and forth among themselves for tools or equipment or clothing. Would trade back and forth among themselves, you know, so many bushels of corn for so many, perhaps, of potatoes. And that's the way it went. They were reduced to what is called a cigarette and nylons barter society, just like Italy after World War II. A chocolate bar, a cigarette, could buy quite a bit. And, of course, that's exactly what it was. One German writer lived through those days and wrote of his own personal experiences. He talked about how farmers at one time, in their common barter, would also accept scrip from companies, private companies and industries, who would print their own money. And at one time it was said that in Germany, prior to World War II, there were as many as 172 kinds of emergency money in circulation. One writer said by the time you got to the store, maybe you could buy a pound of sugar for 2 million. 2 million Reichsmarks. But by the time you got to the counter, it was a half a pound for 2 million. Now, does that sound like something we're seeing happening in the United States with just different, you know, figures after the label there? It sounds like something I've heard. I've seen news accounts where people have gone into the supermarkets and have picked up a can or a package or a box off the shelf and tried to get to the counter with it, but the clerk would say, hold it, I was just going to raise the price on that, and arguments have ensued, and I think maybe even a threatened suit. And, you know, I think that the spectacle of supermarkets, and many of them were named, some of the big chains in the United States, of buying low, buying bulk, before their own costs went up, and then marking up that stuff after it's already been on the shelf, is just plain old blatant human greed. Now, maybe it's not specifically illegal, but it certainly is immoral. It's unethical. If it is not within or outside or against the law, it is maybe extra legal in that sense, but it's certainly immoral. Yes, what happened even in post-World War I Germany of sugar going up maybe double by the time you got it out of the bin and headed for the counter is now happening in the United States of America, except in different figures. We're not up into the billions, as I said. The government could come around and simply tell us, like it did some Germans, that maybe our money has been so devalued that each dollar bill is now or revalued that it's worth 1 million. We could all be overnight millionaires. As a matter of fact, you know what they did? The bank would send a letter to a man who might have thought that he had a small fortune, and he would get a polite letter which would say something to the effect that the bank certainly does sincerely regret that it can't any longer handle his deposit of maybe, you know, 200,000 marks, some modest fortune, since the costs are all out of proportion to the capital. And the bank might politely tell him, since we no longer now have any banknotes in small enough denominations at our disposal to even give you the money that you have in the bank, we've just rounded the sum out to, say, 1 million marks. Enclosed is $1 million, or 1 million mark bill, rather. And what was funny was, you know, the poor guy had a fortune before they did that to the money. He had a small fortune. But they said, we don't have bills that small anymore, so here's your 1 million mark note. And then on the outside of the envelope was a stamp that was canceled that was labeled 5 million marks. The money the guy got was only a fifth of what it cost the bank to send him a letter in the first place. Isn't that unbelievable? It cost millions or billions of marks to buy sardines or sugar or sausages or dairy products or meat, but as a rule, everybody simply went to a barter society. The government, finally, in the year of the deepest inflation, was just about forced to strip the forest bare in Germany. You know that the pulp factories were just going night and day because finally it required 300 separate paper mills and 2,000 government printing presses just to issue currency. It was one of the biggest businesses in Germany for a time. Can you imagine that? However, the government never did really catch up to the demand. It simply could not put enough money in circulation. From January 1923 to the so-called stabilization in November, German currency expanded on the order of 400 million fold. Late in 1923, an egg was selling at 80 billion marks and a loaf of bread for 200 billion marks. By the time that mark was so-called stabilized, finally stabilized, officially devalued and the new exchange rate was set in, it became 1 trillion paper marks to 1 gold mark. When they finally decided to get back to a heavy metal standard, then you could trade in 1 trillion marks for 1. Except the 1 was in gold and the 1 trillion were in paper. Now what happened was really that everybody that was even remotely in the middle class, the upper middle class, the lower upper class, I guess you could say, was totally impoverished, and it created 2 separate classes. Just 1 gigantic, seething, teeming, dissatisfied, miserable, wretched, unhappy, angry, fighting mad lower class. And 1 tiny group of elite upper class. So it destroyed the Weimar Republic. It gave way to the rise of Hitler and all of the inflammatory speeches and everything that promised a chicken in every pot and a Volkswagen in every garage were pretty heady wine for a people who had gone that far down. The point I've been making on this program for some time is that what they do about it in other countries and what the United States does about runaway incredible inflation or deep business recession which might lead toward the impoverishment of the masses are 2 different things. I doubt very much that the United States would see anything other than maybe here and there the imposition of martial law. Maybe here and there literal calling out of army or of reserve troops to keep people from looting stores if it gets to the point where there is any kind of a gigantic panic and people simply run and try to take what they need instead of buying it one way or the other. But be that as it may, in West Germany it doesn't work that way. Some of the countries in Europe simply do not act the way the United States does when some of the big problems come around. But what is inflation? It's simply too much paper money chasing too few goods. Money is nothing by itself. It's all a confidence game. And that oversupply of money results in too much deficit spending by governments. Governments print the money. They stand back of the money. They circulate the money. Their policies through central government banks pretty much decide what money is going to be available and what the interest rates are going to be to fuel the nation's economy. And basically, it's a political problem. The Congress may vote this or that bill for this or that kind of spending. You've heard about Wilbur Mills and a powerful Ways and Means Committee. You've heard of HEW and all of that type of thing as we have moved more and more toward a socialistic kind of a state, a welfare kind of a state, of an absolute, unbelievable cradle-to-the-grave caretaker society. We've got Medicare and Medicaid. We've got all of these unions striking for the fringe benefits. It's not necessarily the hourly wages you've heard on and on and on in everything from coal mining to the automobile industry and every place else you want to go. It's the fringe benefits. It's pensions. It's paid vacations. It's overtime. It's hospitalization. It's what happens if they're injured on the job. All of that type of thing. And that's understandable. I'm not necessarily complaining about it. I'm really saying that's what it is. That's what happens. Now, it works basically this way. The Congress may vote in some bill. Maybe it's defense spending. Maybe it's something else. But the Treasury then spends it, and it spends more money than it's taking in. The only way to take in money for the government is to increase taxes. But increasing taxes is terribly, terribly unpopular politically. Governments don't get to stay in office very long by gigantic tax increases. But governments can get elected and voted into office on platforms of tax cuts. Then they usually can't bring it to pass, even though they get in, because they find what? Well, they've decided they're going to run on, let's say, 5 or 6 social programs. Maybe the president or the governor that we're talking about runs on the idea that he's going to release all the terrible burdens of people on fixed incomes, and he's going to raise the welfare payments to people. He's going to raise pensions. He's going to raise Social Security benefits. He's going to give all kinds of money to ex-servicemen, to injured people, elderly people, retired workers, and whatnot. Plus, he's going to make more unemployment assistance available. And there's going to be a lot of government money funneled into the area of people who need it and who are on fixed incomes. Well, where's he going to get that money? Well, the Treasury Department. The Treasury Department will simply issue a lot of IOUs. It writes a lot of paper and says, I owe myself some money. And then it issues bonds and bills, paper money, to make up the difference. Now, as long as the increase in money supply that's dumped on the market is about the same as the amount of goods available, growing at about the same rate of production, as long as money in circulation and goods in circulation or in production are about the same, you've got what is called a stable economy. But if money begins to outrun the goods, then good old greedy, rotten, jealous, lustful human nature steps in. And people say, I want to get mine while the getting is good. And there's a great deal more money available, and there are schemes to get it. Some people decide to rob a bank, and other people decide to con the public. But in any event, everybody wants to get his. Now, the greatest reason, as I said at the beginning of this program, for the increase in money supply was the incredible deficit spending during that 10 years of protracted battle in Vietnam when government defense spending was at an unbelievable all-time high. That huge expenditure for Vietnam was never offset by the logically required increased taxes. And the war was so unpopular that an increased tax vote would have been equally unpopular. Anybody who seriously, as a government official, would have suggested raising taxes to be able to afford the Vietnam War in the mid-60s when up to 65 American cities were in flames, when American campuses were seething hotbeds of civil rights or anti-Vietnam War demonstrations and that type of thing, for anyone to have tried to have gotten through a big program of increased taxation at that time in order to be able to afford the war in Vietnam, I'm not even sure they would have bothered trying to impeach him. They might have simply tried to burn him at the stake. So economists might have made all sorts of protests, might have told the government that you've got to raise taxes or else inflation is going to come along. But raising taxes would have been terribly, terribly unpopular, so people simply couldn't do it. And as long as people want to get something for nothing, and as long as politicians want to promise that the people can get something for nothing, then the people elect the politicians, and the politicians try to serve the people as best they possibly can, and each of them live in a kind of a dream world, which is unreal and untrue, and so inflation develops. But you know, the only way to solve inflation is by strong, concerted central leadership, and that's fact. Finally, inflation will become a deep governmental problem, a political problem. And in other countries, it usually results in some military dictatorship and a loss of freedom if there is no solution. So inflation begins when the government begins to give out an awful lot more money and print a lot more money and dump more money in circulation than the government is taking in taxes and other ways of earning money. And that's what we've been seeing for the better part of a decade in the United States, and so we're now beginning to pay the piper. There's never going to be any resistance to that kind of spending. The government could right now, today, announce that it's voted X number of billions for social programs, it's voted X number of billions for highways, it's voted billions to subsidize railways, trucking firms, and airlines, it's voted more billions for health programs, it's voted billions for veterans benefits, it's voted additional billions for defense spending, it's decided to launch a new space probe, it's decided to heat up the arms race again, and even though there would be certain political consequences about the arms race effect of it, everybody would be deliriously happy. They'd say, oh, fantastic, the government's going to release all these fantastic funds, we're all going to get some money. The government could announce tomorrow that it's decided it's going to vote $50 billion for inner urban reform and for rapid transit systems for the big cities and for tearing down all the urban blight and building new government housing. I suppose everybody would be rubbing their hands and just as happy as they could be. They'd be popping a cork like in the NFL football locker after the successful game and pouring it on one another, saying, oh man, how much is our city going to get? They'd say, well, just a mere $2 billion. Oh boy. And everybody would just be going crazy. They wouldn't realize what the long-term consequences of all this worthless paper money that we pour into the economy are going to finally be. But there will be a great deal of resistance to higher taxes to pay for it. So, really, it's a kind of a fantasy that everybody plays. The government's only human, after all, as they say about the Volkswagen. And government is made up of men. So we can vote people into office that we feel are going to change the terrible impending depression. Now there are many parallels occurring. We see back during the Hoover administration, a deep depression sets in. Now the Democrats are making a great deal of hay over the fact that we've got a Republican at the helm of government and a Democratic Congress. And so it's convenient today for the Democrats to blame the Republicans for inflation It's also incredibly stupid because the one major reason for inflation today is a war that grew to incredible limits under a Democratic administration. Remember when people voted Goldwater out? I mean, you know, they didn't want him in the White House because they thought he'd get us in war in Vietnam. So Mr. Johnson was in for his own term in his own right as President of the United States. And so we went to war in Vietnam. Now, Mr. Nixon inherited that war and, of course, finally wound it down and brought it to a conclusion so far as direct American involvement. I won't argue all the points about illegal bombing of Cambodia and all that the kids got so excited about. They were probably right. It probably was illegal, probably shouldn't have been done. I certainly said a great deal, including writing a small book about the subject of what was happening because of American involvement in Southeastern Asia. And the irony of it all, when we originally had begun to support Ho Chi Minh following World War II. But that's all history and lost on most people. The point I'm making today is that it was a Democratic administration that kept going deeper and deeper and deeper during the Johnson era into Vietnam. And all that government defense spending is basically what doubled the money supply in this country from 1964 on, and that's why we've got runaway inflation today, is because of all that money in circulation. Now, we can blame one party or another, we can blame one president or another, and we would be a little bit improper and incorrect, because we should simply be looking at our own human nature, at our own desire to get more, to get something for nothing, to get it while the getting is good, our kind of a free lunch society where we'd like to take the ride for nothing if we possibly could. We ought to look at human nature. Of vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed. The Word of God, which says that's exactly what we are. That we in the human heart basically are deceitful above all things. That the things that we would witness happening in the last times, or the last days, as the Bible characterizes it, that we're seeing right around us, are just like a fulfillment of biblical prophecy that said, as the Apostle Paul said to Timothy, "This know, that in the last days perilous times shall come, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous." The very first things he places in order in 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 and 2, is lovers of self, selfishness, self-centeredness, thinking of me, myself, and I, I'll get mine while the getting is good, covetousness, which is merely lust and desire and greed. And he goes on to say that they would be boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. That's a kind of a cross-section of our society today. Well, inflation is here, and it isn't really being solved. And deep business recession is here, and that's not being solved either. And if you want to know what's ahead, you need your name on the mailing list of The Plain Truth, a unique, hard-hitting, straight-from-the-shoulder publication that makes plain today's perplexing world news in the light of Bible prophecy. The Plain Truth is free of charge, and while you're at it, request the booklet, The United States in Prophecy. Find out where we're mentioned.
All you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.